New.
And that just shows you, you know, how long we've been off the microphone, man. So, yeah. So it's good. It's good to be doing it again, man. Yeah. Like, it's been a minute.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you were telling me before, you know, I pressed this button right here.
Yeah.
That, well, we got some feedback on our episode that we recorded, what, 2 years ago? And if you want to see, like, a rerun of that, you can... I felt like, you know, I was watching a rerun of that episode when I watched tidbits of this Poon interview.
Yeah.
And it was interesting, like...
By the way, you should check out that episode, Manufacturing Descent. Check that out.
Yeah, I'm going to try to, you know, do some... You know how they do it in, like...
Shameless pitch. Yeah, continue.
Wait, is it shameless if it's our own show?
Yeah, no, I don't think it's shameless.
Yeah, probably. I mean... go into depth, though. What was this feedback that we got on this episode?
Okay, so we are, like, super, like, nerdy into this stuff, right? So we have a lot to talk about on these kind of things. But the homie was listening to the episode, which the cool thing about that was it randomly came up on his Spotify. So, yep, we're in the algorithm. Yeah.
We're doing something wrong.
We're doing something. And so he was like, it was good. It was good. It was enjoyable. He listened to the whole thing. And he said there was one thing, though. We went pretty deep back into the history of the Russian people. We went back to the Kievan Rus. Again, to understand all the context for this, check out that episode. But and we went back even into the connection between, like, the Nordic king and the Kievan Rus. And so we went, basically what that means is, in English, we went way back to, like, the origins of the Russian peoples. And he was like, that was kind of a tangent. And to us, that wasn't a tangent because, like, this whole thing is just, like, you know, this world of fascination. Like,
and it's like history playing out.
Front of you, and you're just going back in the timeline.
Yeah.
And so, but the idea being, what somebody is trying to figure out with that conversation, for we kind of scaled it way back, and it became something you had to kind of then wade through.
Definitely. And two years down the road now, since that episode, give or take, almost 2 years down the road, listening to this Putin interview again, just tidbits of it, because, you know,
a lot has been vindicated.
I think he is viewing it from that lens, right? And I feel a lot of people's around... I mean, I would say, let's say, you know, people of countries that are actually, like, you know, power players. Because some people are just rent seekers.
Yeah.
Right? And we'll get into that later on of who is a rent seeker. But I feel like they are viewing this as, like, a chess game, a power match, a power dynamic. It's just the differences. Some of the upper echelon here are viewing it, you know, even in media, even in, like, you know, any stakeholder in the anywhere near the center of power in the US is viewing this as, you know, a few years back, a couple of decades back max, right? You know, a few events back max.
Right.
You know, up to, like, a lot of people will,
their generation, maybe the one before them.
Yeah. And you could, I mean, in this interview, he highlights this history, and he's viewing it that way.
Right.
He feels, obviously, like, you know, like, okay, he thinks that he can connect to whoever's listening to this.
Right. And for context, it was one question that he was asked, and he gave, like, a good, what, 45-minute or so response.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah.
Which goes to show that... Now, you look at him, you look at a country like... And that's not to fixate on him, the person, but you're talking about the people there. Look at China. These kind of countries, Africa, Latin America, they're not thinking about... These people are not thinking in terms of just the past few years of their life, right? Like, the national conscience has a good memory of, like, centuries, right?
Mm.
China still remembers the century of humiliation, 100 years of the West flooding them with opium, basically trying to destroy their society so that they can be economically crippled because they were big. And a lot of people in America, they don't, they look at China and they'll just think about what they're taught of China in the past, what, 50 years? Starting with Mao. Everything before Mao was ancient.
I mean, honestly, I don't think anyone was learning anything. In this country, no one's learning anything about anything anyways, right? But as far as China is concerned, the national memory goes back to probably 1990. And China being an actual villain of any scale, probably 2000 and, you know.
In China's national memory?
Or in the U.S. memory.
Right, whereas China is thinking, hey, in this century, that happened. Now, if you were to tell that to the typical person here, they would be like, well, that happened a long time ago. Why does it matter? But that it is the difference, is that people aren't thinking like that in other parts of the world. People in Africa are still thinking about, hey, we were colonized in whatever year.
It's been a transformation. From like people thinking China is just, you know, manufacturing cheap goods to this is the future. This is the superpower. It's happened within the last 15 years in our, like, you know, we've seen it within, like, you know, in front of our own eyes,
right.
Where people have been foretelling, even in this country, people, the media has been foretelling the downfall of China and its economy and, you know, its government and a revolution, a color revolution within its borders for 15, 20 years now.
Right.
Right. And that 20 years has seen China go from, you know, someone, I guess, not even on the sidelines to one of the people who, like, they have the scale of power. They're not a small player anymore. Right. They're not a small stakeholder in that sense. And I feel like, you know, if you take a smaller countries that are dealing with issues, faults.
A lot of countries in West Africa who are now, again, going back in time and saying, hey, we're still facing the... We're still being detrimented by colonialism. No one in America remembers that no one in France is probably saying, hey, yeah, we colonized Nigeria or Niger and they're still effectively a colony of us.
Yeah.
They're going to be talking about, hey, I see all these immigrants around me. Why are they here? And that's where the memory stops. It's a historical amnesia.
There is, I feel like, you know, if there is an intertwinement with, if not the state and its interests, then the cultural interest or the religious interest, in a sense, right?
Yeah.
There. Where I feel like once here in the U.S. right now, you do see this political nihilism, but there's also a societal nihilism, right?
Yeah.
There is an overall, like, a weird vacuum, a cultural vacuum of every sort you can imagine. And maybe this is my imagination speaking, but I see it. And this nihilism is a little bit even more crippling than something you would face there, because where you can get disillusioned with politics, you can find, you know, some kind of you can find something in religion.
Yeah.
You can find, as in, there is like a space for you there.
Right.
A religious space or a nationalist space.
Yeah.
If not nationalism of, like, you know, nation states, then nationalism of ethnicity or language or tribe.
Right.
But, you know, there is a nihilism here right now. I think the Biden election has accelerated this political nihilism.
Oh, yeah.
I think 2016, people really got motivated both ends of the spectrum this country.
Yeah.
And I think 2020 was a big hush-up call to every segment of the population. And I feel the State Department abroad and then the inner, you know, cogs of the machine, domestically, they've been moving much more efficiently in hushing up opposition.
Yeah.
Abroad and at home.
Definitely, yeah.
And I think one of the ways they've done it here is indie media, you know, kind of taking over, getting money in.
Right.
You know, I feel anyone who is even a counterculture streamer right now online, you know, doing the bit of, hey, we're not mainstream media, we're not this, we're not that, we're not bought, we're not, but they have some kind of financier, some kind of if not anything, let's say if not anything, a TUS to go by. Uh-huh. And we were when we were doing the Ukraine thing, what was the main issue? A main issue was what you're saying, because what can be perceived as, you know, offensive, quote, you know, not, I mean, let's say not offensive, even like
politically incorrect.
I'm saying, like, you know, at times where you're seeing people losing their jobs,
yeah,
you know, like who can get doxxed for what, where, yeah. And I'm again,
that
like,
right now with anti-Semitism, supposed anti-Semitism.
I think we've both been on that, like, where we expect that, hey, you know, our address might be online or something of that sort. And yeah, it is a difficult thing to, like, kind of like, you know, maneuver, where, like, the, I mean, we obviously have to be careful what we're saying, and to get to the level where some of these big time, you know, indie media people who are leading fringe politics in this country, to the point where they're at, I just don't know how you get there without, like, a lot of support from the machine itself, or at least having to play by the, like, very strict rules. A TOS that can kick you off at any given moment and censor you, what you're saying, maybe.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
a financier or anything. Your own audience at times.
Your own audience. Yeah. Could be your own audience. The platform that you're hosted on.
If you are not doing, let's say you're not doing anything and you're making six figures now, seven figures now, just playing a video game or whatever, why would you not be like, you know, why would you not think you're, I mean, like, it doesn't have to be something even like by greed, or people hit like a peak in life and they just feel like whatever, like, wave that is, that's the truth.
Yeah.
And yeah. It could be like in politics, a lot of times people hit this type of, like, you know, awakening. And again, people do this in other countries through sometimes, you know, politics itself, or like religion, or, you know, oh, not, like, I found my heritage, or what, you know, I'm going back to, like, what the actual root yeah. cause of inequality or inadequacy yeah. in societal, like, you know, whatever the issue, right. societal chaos is. But I'm finding that a vacuum that is artificial. It's created, I feel like, you know, on purpose right now. Yeah. There's been a dumbing down. Like, as in, like, the machine existed before 2016.
Right.
Before 2020. It's accelerated. There's been, like, much more vapid content around this. There's not much anyone can talk about.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to talk about, but I mean,
and not in the narrow confines of American political critique. Okay, even, yeah, like, let's,
yeah,
say,
yeah, right,
you can go, right. back right now to, let's say, 2008, 2012, where there was a critique of Obama online from people who are getting millions of views, right? Yeah. And those same folk right now, when push comes to shove, would be very hard pressed to do that with Biden.
Right. Right.
And you saw that in 2020.
Yeah.
And now you saw that, honestly, falling in line, so to speak, in 2022 with this Ukraine-Russia yeah. invasion.
Yeah.
And you really had to, you know, like, pick a side or force the vote, even, right?
Yeah.
You saw that, before, right? And, yeah. like, I did, I mean, you saw it even in, like, you know, our own social circles, where there is a kind of rift now where people are like, oh, you're a, you know, Jimmy Dore guy, or you're just a conspiracy theorist, oh, AOC this, or, like, you know, like a lot of, like, teaming up type stuff.
You're a Putin supporter?
Yeah, you're an imperialist.
You're a Putin supporter? How do you even support Palestine?
Yeah, exactly. That kind of, you know, like, yeah. over-the-top, ridiculous, you know, like, just, like... I really don't know, because what caused people here to fall in line that quickly? Even people, I'm saying, like, you know, the average citizen who has no external force other than media being exerted on him, to fall in line that quickly, apart from this nihilism itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Apart from this nihilism itself, like, hey, let me fall in line with someone like, you know, like the squad, something as vapid as something like the squad. Or, I mean, honestly, like, you know, if you go, like, think of the, you know, just the, like, adolescent nature of calling any type of political coalition, like, you know, the squad, and having to, like, you know, carry the banner, the water for it. but people willingly, grown men doing that. Doing that, we've had arguments, full out discussions. We've had people jump on behind the microphone and then ready to walk around the room and, like, you know, like throw hands. And it's based on what? Based on who? Like, as in, it's not based on some movement. It's not based on some charismatic figure that's gonna, like, you know, some visionary statesman. It's like, you know, just some random folk, literally. Like, you know, like, I'm talking about, like, you can take all five of the members of this, like, political coalition at that time. There's nothing riveting. There's other than, yeah, they might agree with you on some things. Yeah, great. But as in, like, as, like, I can be a critic and be like, hey, you know, Bill Clinton might hold a room very well.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that these people could not hold a room like that. And there's nothing behind it more than, like, I feel, yeah, there's a good story. And at times I do feel like there is some kind of, like, push from organizations that are working with, you know, like, that have clandestine ties. Because I don't believe anyone can get to those rooms of power without that balancing.
I think that's been proven in the past few years that's made itself apparent, right? People develop ties with the institution when they get in the institution, and that kind of becomes that. If they haven't done it before, and for the most part, there's something or the other when they get in the party machine or something or the other that funnels them into that, you know, whether directly or indirectly, different organizations that promote civic participation and things like that.
But I never understood that about, you know, because you are join a party and join like a card carrying member of some party in any other country.
Yeah.
And there is just way more involvement. And we've been in, I mean, me and you have been involved with different like types of organizations, even though I've never voted for either of those parties in my lifetime. But whenever we've gone just for engagement's sake out, it's just a way different dynamic. I feel like the organizations want to keep their own, they want to keep the structure of their organization very, like, you know, hollowed out.
Okay.
Like, the level of participation in the political process is narrow by design, and I think the overall, like, you see this in, like, any time, you saw this with Obama and Bernie, as soon as they were done running, the dismantling of the organization they created, you know, whatever it is, it's just gone.
Right.
And I find it very much like a concerted effort.
100%, yeah. And this is a pattern you can see growing increasingly, but for elections, as long as I remember, right? You had, for me, like, Obama, I was in, like, high school, and I was like, oh, yeah, this guy's great, like, this is gonna be awesome, like, healthcare and this and that. Come to find out, well, he's the same imperialist as the rest of them, and he's actually progressing it.
I mean, my own understanding of this, like, I was in high school at the time Obama was running, and I thought, you know, okay, this guy, first time I actually ever heard of Obama was Pardon the Interruption. This show on ESPN, and this guy had given his support to the Bears, and he was like, hey, New Orleans, I'm really sad for you, but, you know, go with Chicago Bears, whatever. Okay. But
when he was like Chicago senator,
gotcha. And it was like, okay, it's interesting, he's running for president, you know, this guy's an outsider. I definitely didn't want Hillary to win, obviously. And, you know, even at that time, there was a good time post Iraq war where I, you know, when you saw like the unlike, there was just no just a naked exertion of power by the U.S. in that war, and then actually taking over the country, and then, you know, business as usual, everyone goes back to their day job. Now, I mean, obviously abroad, you know, people came out in full force, but, you know, domestically, you know, there's just like a very big, like, gulf between, you know, the effects of war. Right? There is a big, you know, what people feel closer to the, you know, where the actual, I guess, the chaos is ensuing.
Yeah.
it's much more different when we're like all the way here.
Right, right. Which lends to that nihilism and also is perpetuated by that nihilism.
I mean, there's no solution to it as far as electorally, in my opinion, anyways. Because, like...
This is the pattern we've seen. Electoralism, lesser of two evils, it gets worse and worse and worse and worse. Yeah. When does it end?
And that's very... I feel like... I don't want to make this a principle, because, like... I think in other countries, like, you know, Pakistan just had their election. And there are, like, places where you can go and... There are, like, you know, you vote and might have some kind of tangible effect. Here in the U.S., when you're going to vote, first and foremost, who's on the ballot... we already see who's, you know, the filtration of that going through primaries and how, you know, those are coalesced by the machine. And that is right now when everything is maybe in front of us. Imagine, you know, I mean, we need to imagine, we can just go back and read in, you know, 100 years, 200 years ago, the different, you know, like politicking going on to get these guys on the ticket to the forefront, what they're going, like, what is their view of political economy? What class they're coming from? And you can really understand a lot about, the political nihilism is inbred. It's baked into the cake, because the free land and free labor dynamic at play throughout most of the history of this country. Well, most of, like, you know, yeah, I guess in most of the history. I forgot how old this country is, you know. But
200, whatever.
Well, yeah, like, you know. The westward expansion, taking over of territory, and then the cultural growth of this, like, the cultural hegemony that has kind of, you know, taken full hold of the world, unmatched by anything.
The USSR couldn't even stand up to it.
The USSR can't stand up to a thousand-year-old thousands of, you know, civilizations that have withstood time.
Yeah.
They can't talk about this type of, you know, hold on the world.
Right.
That the, you know, this is really...
China again.
Hegemony of world conquest proportions.
Yeah.
And the military might of world conquest proportions. And the strategic and, you know, the geostrategic... right now positioning of world conquest proportions. So only thing that has really kept the US from superseding anyone's imagination of what an imperial power can be, in my opinion, has been just the internal rot of the populace itself, the culture itself.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that as in, like, a slight. I don't mean, like,
the populace. No, there populace. Is a decay.
Yeah, there is a cultural decay. And from the onset, when you have that settler colonial mindset, like, we're seeing it in Israel right now. We're seeing it in Palestine right now, where it kills itself off, right? You cannot have a settler colonial state, a Trojan horse. You just can't go and settle land without repercussion.
Yeah.
Unless you have the blessing, or, like, whatever you want to call it, the resting of free labor and free land from the indigenous populace and the...
From the populace that's there.
The populace that you're importing to enslave.
Yeah.
Right. So unless Israel happened to, you know, get onto unlimited land and whatever they thought in the 18th century was unlimited land almost, and what they thought was labor.
Yeah.
That, honestly, I mean, I would, you know, yeah, there's much more nuance on what, like, the political economy looked like in that sense, where what they foresaw this free labor to actually, like, you know, what was the future of this free labor?
Right.
And, I mean, that was a sticking point.
Slapped them in the face a few months ago.
This free labor.
I mean, the people who they were trying to extract the labor from.
Who?
Israel? Zionists?
You want
to... Like, how is that working out for them internally now?
I mean...
You know?
It's not... You know, that enslavement that they are trying to go towards, I feel like, where they're able to, you know, just dominate to that extend, that takes an Imperial might. It takes, like, you know, a lot of, like, it takes the collusion of a lot of different powers. And you saw that with Africa, where a lot of different powers, they group together, they come together, and now we will try to dominate this land that is already, you know, like, the nation state is such a new phenomena. You could think of it as an enterprise, and when this enterprise, these enterprises form in Europe in the early 19th century, post-Napoleonic Wars, or, you know, a lot of this identity forms, and this competition for Africa forms. They don't, I mean, you know, they're going to dominate peoples who might not have the same organization of society. They do not, they did not see this coalition as, you know, that's coming to dominate them and enslave them as a coalition, maybe, of, like, you know, like, as in, they view themselves as individual kingdoms, individual, independent, whatever, so not as, hey, we are black people.
Right.
Or we are, you know, these are white people. You know,
right.
Or maybe they did. They viewed them all as white people, but they were not viewing themselves as all black people.
Yeah.
Right? And you see this mass, this group, coalition of these nation states that have formed coming to enslave you.
Yeah.
That type of free labor, that's the kind of might you need to actually enslave a populace to that extent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, Israel's on, it seems like, that kind, that's what their vision of the future is, where, hey, we're going to be controlling this piece of land, and everyone who lived here, actually, they're just going to be enslaved by us and work for us, clean our toilets, work for our, you know, work as mechanics, whatever jobs that we don't want, they'll do. I mean, and we'll pay them enough so that they can eat and work for us until they die and, you know, reproduce, and, you know, we can extract whatever we want from this population without anyone saying anything.
Yeah.
And they're facing a difficulty. It's, I mean, multi-pronged, right? I mean, they're facing the fact that they don't, you know, you don't have the people, bro. Like, as in, like, you can see right now the Zionist regime, the days are numbered.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
The days are numbered.
It's not working out.
Yeah, and we all see the naked exertion of power that the U.S. did in Iraq. Israel thought they can do that today. Well, guess what? You don't have the hegemony. You don't have the backing. And I'm not saying this as in, like, a revolutionary sense or anything. It's a fact. You don't have, I'm not taking pride in the U.S. having hegemony. I'm telling you, if you thought that you had that kind of, like, capital.
Well, they thought, by having the backing of the U.S., they could do whatever they want.
Yeah, they're finding out the U.S. doesn't have that capital.
Exactly. There you go. That's changing.
Yeah, the U.S. does not have that capital anymore either. And, you know, I feel like, you know, that's why there is nihilism. People are seeing there is a divergence of your personal interests with the interest of the state. And the interest of the state is, you know, it seems like the interest of the state lies in fortifying imperial interest, while letting, you know, this turn into some kind of Mad Max situation domestically.
Yeah.
Right?
That is
and
the whole thing.
The law and order situation, whatever it is, you see it, like, you know, if it's imagined, then it, if it's perceived, then, okay, it's perceived, but it's mentally, it's there, you see it. Hey, there's chaos, there's mass protests constantly, Trump came, Trump left, all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And this mass hysteria that's been created, and obviously COVID, I mean, once in a lifetime event happening, it kind of, I feel like it's really caused people to, you know, view things even in a more zoomed in lens than, you know, prior, where maybe, you know, during the Iraq war, people could have thought of, hey, well, the U.S., you know, we need to show people who's boss or something. Something primitive of that. Something high school football player, like, type, like that.
Very Neanderthal, like, you know.
Yeah.
Barbaric type of mentality.
Yeah, and now, honestly, I feel like a rational person on the street, if they ever, like, you know, like, if they hear that anyone, I'm talking about any color, any, like, whatever your politic is, it's a very rational response or a rational thing to hear. Yeah, but what about just fixing it here? What about fixing things here? And it wouldn't be considered an anti-American thing. You wouldn't be framed as an anti-American. Like, you know, 20 years ago, I mean, we've had to probably filter our thoughts in public spaces before.
A bunch.
Because, you know, you don't want to be like... It's not about being scared or anything. It's just like the inconvenience of being labeled as like, oh, you're an anti-American. You're a sympathizer of this. You're like, you know, like, you have to denounce this before you can enter this conversation.
Right. Right.
Denounce this organization before you enter this conversation.
Do you condemn Hamas?
Do you condemn Hamas? Yeah, well, yeah, the babies are dead, but do you condemn Hamas? Like, you know, like, that kind of situation, it's, that filtration, that filter has kind of fallen off right now with Israel.
But there you go, though. You see, that is where that historical amnesia comes in. Do you condemn Hamas for what they did on October 7th? Right? History started on October 7th.
And do you find that to be naivete, or do you find that to be actually, like, you know, self-interest?
Both. Both.
Oh, willful ignorance.
I think the naivete is in favor of self-interest, right? Ignorance is bliss.
Hmm.
Right? So at a certain point, you know, but then you're like, okay, I know enough. It doesn't matter now. I don't need to know what happened 200 years ago. That was a long time ago. Right? Mm. What happened on October 7th? I don't need to know what happened decades ago. You know what I mean? So you see, I feel like a lot of lack of opposition to war in the U.S. from the populace. Part of that comes from, one, people don't remember the lessons that people said they learned from Vietnam today, but also they don't want to know. It's not convenient. It doesn't serve their material interests. Right? So there is a naivete there, but it's also like, hey, I know enough to know that I don't need to know more and I don't want to know more. This is what it is.
It's just self-serving.
Yeah, it's self-serving.
I mean, again, when you have discerned that, you know, that there is a divergence between your interest and the state's interest, even then you're going to be focused on your own, like, you know, here and now interest. So when there is an anti-war movement, the first thing you have to, like, we used to have to say is, our tax dollars are going to... What do you mean? Let's say they were... As in, like... You know, we give $3 million to Israel every year.
Yeah.
And, or something of that, whatever, $3 billion.
You have to use these kind of appeals rather than the fact that, hey, the actual issue is this ego-driven, profit-driven need to expand, constant appetite that capitalism has. You live in the bastion of that. You need to know the whole history of all of that, right? But history is boring, and you don't talk about politics and
political economy is too niche. Everything is just too deep into it.
Religion and politics. I wonder why.
I wonder why.
I think maybe because those two things can, one, give you a vehicle to actually mobilize and do stuff, but also give you a framework that's deeper than just my interests of what's in front of me.
Like, it's not polite. It's considered impolite to talk about politics or anything or, like, culture.
Yeah. It's contentious. It could be controversial. Why is controversy a problem?
Yeah. Yeah, so, wait, so you can't talk about it at work.
Yeah.
And you can't talk about it in your social circles.
Yeah.
The expanded social circle, extend. I mean, depending on who you're sitting down with, well, but in polite circles, society, whatever,
quote, unquote. You can talk about it here.
Yeah. But, you know, whatever, like, the... You know, like...
Out and about.
Yeah, you just shouldn't talk about it. You know, even in, like, a coffee house, you shouldn't get too loud about this, you know? Like, so other people can hear. People shout you down. Yeah. And it's like, wait a minute. So you can't really talk about this anywhere, then.
Yeah.
No one's telling you not to, but if you spend... The only place is just wherever you go, you can't talk about
it. And you're told this because, hey, this is an inconvenience. It's a social inconvenience.
And we are so propagandized, we don't understand that this is not an accident. Like, this is not...
There is the problem right there.
Yeah.
Is that people don't even realize that, hey, they're telling you this for a reason. Maybe you should talk about this. Maybe you should forget about talking about it. Maybe you should think about it. And you'll realize, hey, they are telling you this for a reason.
But I mean, right now, I think, you know, with Biden and this election, this upcoming election, I'm hearing more noise. A little bit more noise, not from, like, the average person, because I think the average person had probably knew, like, you know, like, unless you were a diehard DNC guy, even the anti-Trumper Biden voter knew this guy is senile a little bit.
Yeah.
Right? Or he's losing it, but, you know, maybe he'll survive 4 years. Yeah. I think in the mainstream, they've been keeping up the charade. You know, the emperor has clothes.
Yep.
Has clothes on. But recently, I've been hearing much more about this. Much more Kamala is great. Much more, you know, Biden is old. People are worried he's old. I think Hillary came out and said that's an issue. And that was like, that was...
Wasn't there some document or like some evaluation or something that was done from it? Like officially, medically said, like, yeah, he's an elderly person in cognitive decline or something along those
lines. It's some court case, something came out. I think. Uh-huh. That is like, that said, hey, you can't say this, or you can't, you know, he can't be like prosecuted for something. I'm not exactly sure honestly about this.
Yeah.
I've been hearing more about this, but I've been fairly disinterested. We're getting Trump-Biden again, minus, you know, Biden dropping out. But again, going back, this is sounding more and more like a realistic possibility to me, simply because...
What's a realistic possibility?
That, hey, during the convention or something, right before that, you know, drops out, and they didn't do a primary. Yeah. So there's no, like, they can pick and choose.
Hmm.
They'll pick and choose
who, sure, you know,
whip up the votes, fall in line. Easiest thing possible for them.
Yeah.
As in, like, I mean, realistically, no one was going to fall behind Dean Phillips or Marianne Williamson. And I think all three of the candidates, supposedly, right now, again, if as far as electoral politics in this country, we can talk about this Israel-Palestine thing. All three of the DNC candidates were pro-Palestine, pro-Israel.
Pro-Israel, yeah.
Dean Phillips, Marianne Williamson.
They're all Zionists.
They're all Zionists. I
2016, 2020, yeah, Bernie Sanders... He is a Zionist. He believes that Israel should be there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Having done what it's done, being what it is, yeah, good. Keep it. It's good.
Yeah.
Keep it there.
And, I mean, honestly, if they're priming Kamala to run against Trump, I mean, I don't know how that plays out. I mean, they're trying to get, I guess they're thinking the younger crowd.
It doesn't play out very far. I don't think anybody likes Kamala Harris. I haven't heard anybody in real life praise Kamala Harris.
I mean, they got Biden to win.
They got Biden to win.
But Biden was a seasoned, you know, people had heard of Biden's name.
Yeah, yeah. People who the Trump era was scary, and they remember Biden from the Obama time when things were more stable domestically in their perception.
Yeah, if I'm
so there's thinking, a comfort that came with Biden.
If I put myself in that, at that, you know, from that perspective, from a DNC, like, you know, perspective, you're like, okay, well, maybe Kamala can corner the young people vote or the minority vote, because Biden's losing that right now, I think.
Miserably.
Well, I don't know about the minority. He's losing it, but because, you know, he's running against Trump, but losing it as in compared to, let's say, how Obama had cornered that.
Yeah, for sure.
Cornered that market.
I mean, cornered that market, yeah. Well, Latinos are increasingly voting for Trump.
I don't think any Muslim American, I mean, I'm not saying any, there will be some people, there will be, you know, there's sellouts in every community, but I don't find any Muslim American to be voting for a Democrat in this election.
No.
No way. Yeah, you'd be very hard-pressed to see him winning, you know, winning the votes of those people.
Yeah,
no way. Within the next 10 months, what is it, 9 months? Yeah, no, that's not happening. Yeah.
I feel like even the kind of like thought leader, not thought leaders, but the people who have a, you know, a voice in the Muslim community, they wouldn't dare to tell anybody to vote for Biden, if for no other reason than just because they know, like, that's not going to fly.
I mean, you could see, like, you know, some kind of very, like, you know, reductive approach, maybe, where, like, hey, we'll, like, you know, reduce, you know, student loan grant or some like, you know, student loan forgiveness for, like, you know, and that'll be like,
I don't know if that would work.
I don't know, a lot can change in 9 months, you know, going back to 2020 February, who would have thought Biden would be president?
Sure.
Right now, realistically, again, I don't see it happening. Whoever the DNC, like, let's say, let's not Biden, let's say it's Kamala, I could see some something happening in the next 9 months where he wins, the Democratic Party wins back that electorate a little bit compared to right now.
Yeah.
I don't see that, you know, happening at this moment. But again, 9 months is a long time.
Right.
Especially, again, for the people, like, you know, here. I mean, it's not the not only the mass, like, of the American population, but the Muslim electorate itself has a very short memory.
Very short memory.
That is definitely tied to our national, you know, consciousness back home. And, you know, go back to, let's say, and I will isolate this on Pakistan. They just had their election, what, a couple of days ago, February 8th. February 9th. So, yeah, maybe about a week ago, actually.
Okay.
And it's been, you know, and now right now there's like a chaotic, you know, it's been a chaotic week. They're still trying to like sort through the corruption and the rigging during the election.
So, brief, brief overview.
I mean, how just, far do you?
No, nah, okay, so there you go, right? There you go. Okay.
Well, I mean,
goldfish memory overview, like just the election.
Well, they threw like a person and they threw Imran Khan in prison, what, I think
several months ago.
Yeah, give or take, and they removed him from power March 2022, something right around like March, April 2022 when this Russia-Ukraine war started, and I think Imran Khan at that time had gone, and I think just a week before his removal, or a week or two before his removal, had gone to Russia, to Moscow, and had tried, you know, actually opening up some kind of dialogue on buying gas.
Gas and wheat, I think.
Yeah.
At a pretty good rate.
And in a very swift, you know, kind of, you can say, legislative coup was removed. And I think there were some cables leaked, or he himself kind of, you know, like him and his party brought to the, you know, attention of the Supreme Court at that time that, hey, the ambassador from the U.S., the U.S. State Department is working in conjunction with their local, you know, syndicates to remove me from power, and we have cables to prove it. The Supreme Court did not, you know, I guess, to say the least, take his side. And, yeah, now he's been released from prison, and it seems like he has a clear mandate in these elections, even with the Pakistani military, the U.S. State Department, their national, you know, their familiar faces as far as, like, you know, the U.S. fronts for the rent seekers, going back to that term, even with their hands on the scales of power, Imran Khan has come out with a clear mandate.
So my question is, the Supreme Court made that decision, and now they just made a decision to let him out of jail. What changed? The justices didn't change, did they?
I think there is a lot of wheeling and dealing going on now with this election.
To add some context, right? The Supreme Court ruled to free him while the military is still the dominant force in the country. The military is the one that brought him in. Well, then bring him in, but they facilitated that. They were in favor of that, at least. As in, he was elected, but they didn't coup him like they could have.
He did not have an anti-military stance by any... And he did, I think he thought he could work in conjunction with the military.
Right.
He did not realize that the military wanted him to work for them.
Yeah.
At least in some aspects. And right. Not but towing the line with this Russia, you know, with this Russia thing... could have been a breaking point for sure, I believe.
Yeah. But those same Supreme Court justices are still under the thumb of the military, I'm assuming. So with that context, why did they not let him out?
Well, I mean,
the same threat.
The military, I think, might have not, you know, understood the extent of people coming out for Imran Khan. And right now, seeing
the military feels threatened?
I feel like right now his release is showing that they, within the corridors of power, they believe that wheeling and dealing will get them through this. Where, you know, even if Imran Khan or his, you know, someone that he selects becomes prime minister, I think whoever he selects, I think he put out a name, Omar Ayyub, who I believe has like some kind of military background of his own,
as
a prime minister, candidate for it at least. I believe the people who have been, you know, playing that game of politics in Pakistan, and it's a very select few families that, you know, are in conjunction with the military itself that, you know, actually hold that power. They do believe that they can maneuver through this current chaos and get what they want, which is, okay, the populace, which has come out kind of against the power that be,
yeah,
in this election, they can be kind of, you know, patted on the back, go back home, you know, it's all gotcha. Good, we're good.
Yeah.
And then whoever sits on that chair, be it the people we just threw in jail, let's just talk it through.
We'll handle them.
Yeah, we'll handle them. They'll get what, you know, they'll get what they want, which is, you know, they wanted power, they wanted to, you know, get the throne, so to speak. Okay, you got it, and we just want to hold, you know, the strings that we have always held.
Yeah.
Okay. They believe that they can get that out of Imran Khan, just like they did maybe 4 years ago.
Sure.
Now, I mean, there is popular mandate, right? I mean, I don't want that to be, you know, I don't want to shortchange him in that, because right now, him coming to power while in jail, while the military is visibly against him, while his name is censored on domestic airways,
the
while,
whole establishment is against him.
While his party is banned domestically, people had to run as independent. So I don't want to downplay the popular mandate he has.
Yeah.
In this election and what probably he had in 2018 too, the level of rigging, I feel like right now, it's, I don't want to say it's unprecedented, but we see it. We don't understand maybe in 2018 just because he had won and he had that, you know, kind of that, I guess a check mark. He had like that, you know, like whatever, like the Pak military has signed off on him.
Yeah.
But the powers that be, that stakeholders that, you know, they exerted their own force and there was rigging in that regard against him, even in those, just to make sure. And I feel like that is a maneuver that, you know, if someone has 2/3 majority, if someone has political capital of that sort, let's say you have like the Senate and the House here and a strong executive, they hold a certain level of political capital now to, you know, a certain level of independence now.
Yeah.
And they don't want that in an executive in Pakistan, the military. Right. It works against their
interests.
Their interests, yeah. It works better if there is a divided, you know, parliament.
Right.
If there is a coalition government. And then you can kind of politic maneuver through that a little bit more easily, as opposed to, you know, a guy like Bhutto coming to town.
Right.
Not to compare their caliber as a politician. But I think Imran Khan has, at times, you know, I mean, not, he has the spirit, but he has blundered his way to that conversation, to that category of a statesman.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Even though he's not the caliber of one.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But I don't, it's been interesting to see, you know, whoever gets the throne right now, how they navigate this upcoming debt issue. That is, like, I mean, it's not upcoming, it's been there, but it's going to be expanding at a rate that, you know, they're going to have to, you know, probably start renting out the country, just make it a whole resort at some point. Like, we have no idea how.
Well, I mean, honestly, you could make resorts out of the north. You could have thriving touring. You could have a thriving tourism industry. Honestly,
bro,
they should invest in that. I'm what's the deal with that? Imagine, bro. When the land was colonized by the British upper class would come and like go to like resorts in like Kashmir.
I mean, there is like, you know, there's a lot of potential for industry.
Yeah.
But I feel the financial mismanagement has been at a scale, the kind of eating off the carcass of the state.
Yeah.
This carcass of the country by the state at times has really it just doesn't, it's not allowed for, it's not going to allow for any real industry to thrive for the foreseeable future. People had that, you know, expectation with tech, you know, like becoming a tech hub like India, South India has, right, like the Philippines has. And the work culture combined with...
the work culture.
Yeah, the work culture is one big deal. And I mean, we can... I mean, the work culture being, you know... It is a little bit different.
Drinking chai till 2 a.m. on a weekday and then going to work at 11 a.m. casually.
It's just a mentality thing, I think, in a sense where we are not, you know, willing to take, you know, shit, so to speak.
Right.
From, you know, like a vendor or a client or, you know, anyone who's like, you know, like, you know, everyone thinks they're, you know, for good or for worse, you know, everyone's their own, like, you know, individual. In a sense, unless you are like the forces of power directly exerting themselves on you. If there's the indirect exertion of it, yeah, it goes by, but you yourself feel like, okay, well, you know, and that is distinct from a populist, like, you know, you go to Manila and you see the tech, it's becoming a huge tech hub. And I'm not saying, you know, these are directly... these work culture or like cultural societal issues are directly impacting the tech sectors of it, but whatever interest international companies, multinationals have in these sectors for these respective countries is directly impacted by work culture and the extra, like, you know, curricular activities, the external factors, which, like, right now, I think they had shut down the internet in Pakistan for like 3-4 days earlier, like last year, like the whole
how does a tech industry even run?
And explaining that, I mean, when I was there, I think it was a few years back when I was there, it was raining. I mean, not that hard, honestly. And I went to go get wire some money or something, and they were having an issue with the electricity and. Something. It was just like a weird, like, thing. It's like middle of a work day, but nothing is functioning.
Yeah.
And it was just...
How does a country like that run?
How do you provide a vendor service when, you know, you're like... How do you meet deadlines properly? How do you go about it in any way? And on a global scale, where you are trying to cut costs, find efficiency in this capitalist, like, you know, paradigm. Yeah. Like, there's no reason for you to select something like, you know... Pakistan to, like, be your provide you vendor services or something of that sort from the tech sector.
Yeah.
Or, like, when it, you know, I think the textile industry is something, you know, like, again, like, you know, a big deal in Pakistan, but how much it's been able to scale has been limited by just overall the different stakeholders. They want to keep things as is, which is we don't need to scale this because we're already running it. That's financially
crippling. Yeah,
it's financially crippling. You taking out more loans in the name of the country, renting out the country, and then, you know, using those loans to, like, you know, fill up your bank accounts, and a decades long process, and that you see kind of unfolding in front of you within the next year or two with this debt. Debt crisis in Pakistan that they will be facing within the next year or two.
Yeah.
So whoever sits on the throne now, you can say, you know, if it's Imran Khan, we have public mandate, and we have, you know, we have 2/3 majority. Let's say you say and you get it. Well, it won't be easy from there. It will be much more difficult, and more likely than not, you know, whoever's in that situation is gonna fail.
Yeah.
Because again, this is a decades long project that reversing. Well, or even stopping, slowing down will take so long.
Right.
That someone doing it within one term, right, would be, like, within a 5-year term, or would be close to, like, just, you know, wishful thinking. It's just not possible. Like, yeah. It would be...
Given the state of things and given the military control in the background, right? Well, yeah. I mean, you saw Imran Khan tried to do something and the consequence of that.